I'm Jason Bradford.
I'm Asher Miller.
And I'm Rob Dietz. Welcome to Crazy Town, where you get a colony, you get a colony, everyone gets a colony.
This is producer Melody Travers. In this season of Crazy Town, Jason, Asher, and Rob are exploring the watershed moments in history that have led humanity into the cascading crises we face in the 21st century. Today's episode exposes how religious and political leaders rationalized colonization and exacted a terrible toll on indigenous peoples. The watershed moment took place in the year 1493. At the time, the estimated carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere was 282 parts per million, and the global human population was 371 million.
Rob, Jason, we're pretty good friends, right?
Mostly,
yeah. I mean,
you'd say you know quite a bit about me, don't you?
Yeah. In fact, that's what people say. They go, you know Asher better than anybody.
Right.
I thought I knew him better than
yeah,
anybody.
Yeah, well, I don't know.
Okay. Well, so...
Okay, yes, we're pretty good friends.
Yeah.
We've established that.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to test that. Did you know that I am an amateur papal historian?
Wow.
Papal as in like... of paper?
The Vatican, the Catholic Church.
Yeah.
I did not.
That's great.
I did not know this, but I still feel like I'm a friend of yours.
Right.
Like I knew from our last episode before that, I knew you wanted to be named Steve. Steve the Papal Authority.
Right. Exactly. Well, it's actually something that all Jews have to do. They're forced to study the history of the Vatican.
The Catholic Church,
I don't think you're correct on that.
Front. Okay. It's not actually true. But we're going to be talking quite a bit about the Catholic Church today. In fact, I want to introduce a new character to our show.
Okay.
Crazy Town. His name is Pope Alexander VI.
Nice.
I guess there were five Alexanders before him. I don't know how many after. Yeah.
Could popes have a negative number? Like, could you be Pope Alexander the negative third?
This guy would definitely be in the negative camp. And here's why, okay? He's arguably the most corrupt and depraved of all the popes ever.
Really?
What a title. He holds the belt like a UFC fighter.
Yeah, it's actually part of his title.
Most depraved.
Well, so he's...
Well, what did he do?
Well, he's infamous for throwing lots of orgies, which of course, that's like a standard thing.
Well,
for
a share, the Catholic orgy movement traces back to this guy, but I mean, he's revered among
orgyite
among the members of the Catholic orgy movement.
Right. Didn't they refer to him as Pope Orgasmus the 69th?
I mean, the paintings
so
you can find of like the red robe spread throughout the Sistine Chapel and the nubile bodies everywhere. It's just
If we had any Catholic, like devout Catholic listeners, I think we've probably lost them all.
Well, I have a lot of respect for people I know who are Catholic. I don't necessarily have respect for an ancient depraved pope. So what did this...
Okay, enough. He
had orgies, but what else did this guy
well,
do?
Well, yeah, and the reason I'm bringing him up is not so much the orgies, although it seems like you got a glint in your eye there, Jason. I'll just tell you a little story. In order to be named the pope, the papacy... He went on this campaign of bribery, blackmail, threats to the other cardinals. That way he managed to secure the votes of the majority of them, 17 of the 22. So he like set out on this campaign. By the way, his uncle before him was also Pope.
This is all the Da Vinci codes.
If you say so.
Okay.
But I think a little bit more relevant than this sort of backstory is the fact that he and his uncle were the only two popes that ever came from Spain. Right. And there's a strong connection to Spain. And keep that in mind as I bring up why we're even talking about that.
Okay.
We're not here to bash the Catholic Church. We want to actually talk about something that this specific pope did, which was draft the papal bull known as the Inter Caetera or Caetera.
Okay.
I'm probably butchering that.
Yeah, I'm looking at the way it's written. If you want to go Latin on that, you want to say Caetera. But I'm sure if we Englishify it, if that's a word, it would be cetera or something like that.
Yeah, like et cetera, et cetera. And we'll get to why this papal bull is important, but let me give a context for why it matters. It was in response to a request that the Pope received from the Spanish crown, right? Remember his ties to Spain. And that was after Columbus. Remember that dude?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. I think if you're a U.S. citizen, you ought to know something about Christopher Columbus.
So Columbus sent a letter to the royal family, King and Queen of Spain, in early 1493, February, mm-hmm. writing of, and I'm quoting here, "Islands with marvelously temperate breezes and marvelous meadows and fields incomparable to those of Castile, and the same could be said of the rivers of great and good waters, most of which are gold-bearing." Hmm. Ding, 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 ding.
Yeah.
How come when everybody wrote back then, they couldn't just say it's a great river? It had to be great and good. That doesn't make any sense.
The key thing here is gold-bearing.
Yeah.
He wrote of gold and spices and pepper and cotton and innumerable slaves.
Oh, yeah. They were just sitting there waiting.
Right.
Just asking to be enslaved.
And 1,000 other things, quote-unquote, of importance yet to be found, right? So he's writing them of this discovery. The dude was trying to find China. He found this instead.
Wait, I thought he was trying to find India.
Oh, yeah, India. Excuse me. My bad. And then he sent this letter to them basically saying, hey, we got all this stuff here. We got to go and discover and conquer. So they immediately requested, they wrote a letter to the Pope, and they requested that he sanction their claim to this newly discovered land.
Okay, he wants the stamp of the Pope to say, this is ours.
Right.
Okay.
So, and it was in response to that just a short while later, and we're talking about a matter of months here, which is like lightning speed at that time.
Jeez.
Right. That Pope Alexander drafted the Inter Caetera.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, when you talk about trying to get something drafted, it was person A had to shout to person B, who was, what, like 100
smoke
yards
signals.
Away, and then they had to shout to person C.
Yeah.
Before we go further here, when we started talking about this, I didn't know what a papal bull was, and I think that's a pretty obscure term. So I looked it up.
We're not talking about livestock.
Right.
No, this is not Spanish
no bullfighting. Yeah. Right. So let's define it a little bit. So a papal bull was kind of a really important document that would be issued by the Pope. It was usually some kind of dogmatic pronouncement, some sort of theological statement. And the word itself, the bull, comes from the bulla.
No.
Well, yeah, I know, right? A load of papal bullshit. No, it comes from bulla, which was a lead seal. So it was like this little medallion that would have the name of the Pope and maybe some saints on it to sort of lend more air of importance and weight to this document. The whole thing's kind of weird. I think when you started talking and you used the word papal, like that's kind of a weird adjective. I'm a word guy, so I like to figure out how to use these things like a spelling bee contestant. So I made up a sentence. Inter Caetera is a load of papal bull. There.
Oh,
I've,
very
I've
nice.
Used it in a sentence.
Okay. Well, at this time, this is before the Protestant Reformation. So the Catholic Church kind of had a monopoly on Christianity at the time and in Western Europe here. And so the geographers and historians really highlight the importance of the Catholic Church for these permission granting, right? Providing sort of an aura of religious.
In some ways, you think of it as like international court, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
the highest court is
dealing with jurisdictional issues or disagreements between different Catholic nations, right?
Yeah.
You had a kingdom, but how do you resolve issues between them or make determinations about who owns what or whatever, right?
Right.
They turn to the church.
I was thinking it was more like the church was mom and dad. You got to go ask their permission to sleep over at Billy's house tonight.
Kind of both, yeah.
Yeah, go take lands from people. For an example, there's an Australian geographer, O.H.K. Speight, and in his book, The Spanish Lake, he kind of explained this with this quote, "By immemorial prescription, only the papacy could authorize missions to heathen lands. And naturally, such authority was normally accorded to specific rulers or religious orders." So it's kind of they're divvying it up, you know, specific countries and the rulers and specific religious orders within the church sort of had then the authority to go do this colonizing.
Now, of course, we're just talking about how corrupt Pope Alexander VI was. It wasn't just a one-way dynamic. It wasn't just mom and dad in the case of like these kingdoms needing to ask for permission from the Vatican for things. there's a lot of reciprocity happening here, scratching of backs. And in his case, there's speculation that he was seeking favor from the Spanish court for money or permissions for things that he wanted for his own family and his own personal wealth. So that dynamic is obviously complex there, right? And I think what's important to recognize here in talking about this particular papal bull is that it was actually one of a series of papal bulls and actually a treaty that was passed between Portugal and Spain that sort of created together what people call now the doctrines of Christian discovery.
So you're saying the Inter Caetera papal bull plus some other papal bull that came later. I refrain from adding to the phrase papal bull, that forms this doctrine of discovery that then does what?
Well, that's what we're going to talk about, why this is such a watershed moment. But just to put it into context, you know, there was actually a previous one. In our last episode, we talked about the African slave trade and the creation of racism. There was a papal bull that decreed in 1452 that gave Portugal permission, and I'm quoting here, to reduce any Saracens, which was their word for Muslims, and pagans, and any other unbelievers to perpetual slavery. So there's this kind of continuation of ones that were passed that gave more and more sort of specific authorization for how the world, this new territory, first Africa, and then after Christopher Columbus sailed and went to the Caribbean, the Western Hemisphere, right? And it's those together that kind of create this, what's now called this doctrine of discovery.
Okay, so I do want to point out that, as we often do in this show, there's always nuance, there's always complexity. It's never this just obvious cut and dried. Even though we're presenting this as a watershed moment in history, there was debate and differences of opinion at the time. So there's a theologian in Spain by the name of Francisco de Vitoria, who actually had a different view on how you should treat indigenous people in the New World and not just allow Spanish colonists to go in and take what they want.
And I mean, he was a contemporary of all this stuff going on.
Yeah,
so he was a member of the Catholic Church. He was, you know, he was...
Yeah, he wrote a few decades later.
Okay.
I think it was in response to the Spanish court looking for more clarification in a sense.
Yeah.
You know, we don't really know what the debate was in terms of, yeah, it's all for your taking, it doesn't really matter, or if there are some rights of indigenous peoples, the result is essentially the same,
and it's,
right?
It's hard to know, you know, what survived in the history books, but he seemed to be a voice of sanity. You know, he's saying that we got to put limits on this justifying of warfare, and the Pope really doesn't have the right to give European rulers this dominion or power over non-Christians.
But you can imagine any big complex institution like the Catholic Church of the time, they probably had all these sort of tensions within it. And there were definitely people with heterodox views that were upset by what they saw and weren't so corrupt and maybe really believed in the sanctity of all life, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
So this may be one of these voices from history that was sort of trying to slow stuff down.
Right. In a sense, we're saying there isn't full excuse for saying, you know, sometimes people excuse and say, well, that was the belief system that everyone had at the time, right? So pointing out the fact that there was actually a debate, even if it might have been a small debate, just takes away any, in my mind, takes away any sort of excuse making in a sense to say, but let's be honest, whether he was a lone voice or there was a minority, you know, voice out there, this was not the dominant, you know, decision.
Yeah, the papal bulls and what followed is, hey, we got dominion. The new world is ours for the taking.
Right.
Let's. I like to step back and look at what's happening broadly, because a lot of times, of course, why we say we're doing things is not necessarily explain why we're doing things or what leads up to it. So what is the drive behind these papal bulls? You know, you say Columbus has just gotten back from the New World. What led him there, for example? What's going on more broadly?
Well, you can always look at the economics. You had this economic drive for, hey, we got to get more gold. We got to get whatever, more spices, other riches. So they're on the hunt for it. I almost think of it like the Columbuses and all these guys are like dudes with metal detectors on the beach, and they're just like frantically searching the world for whatever they can find.
Yeah, I mean, gold is fascinating because it was the currency back then. And if you could amass gold, you could then buy things and trade. So that's an important thing. And I think connecting that to what's going on in the climate and ecologically in Europe is interesting. There was a medieval warming period, which allowed for improved crop production in Europe and population growth and sort of a cultural flourishing coming out of the Dark Ages. And
sounds so cozy, the medieval warming period.
Yeah. Well, that had turned the corner. And by the 1300s, and of course then into the 1400s, what we're talking about, things were kind of a mess in Europe. There was a lot of starvation, disease, a lot of different wars going on, a lot of scapegoating politically. There's, you know, witch trials and these kind of things, just making up stuff about who the bad people are because people are hungry and scared. So this is in the background when these exploration and seeking other lands is going on.
Yeah, there's obviously the resource driver and the dynamics of population and all that stuff. There's also great conflict that had been going on for centuries between the Catholic Church, Catholics, and Islam,
yeah.
Right? And that had spread into Southern Europe. And the beginning of colonization in Africa was really a struggle against Muslim control of North Africa. Mm-hmm. And in a lot of this, I think the Catholic Church was sort of justifying this expansion and provide a cover by basically saying, you're there to convert these pagans and these heathens, to save them, right?
Yeah.
Even right. If the true motivation was gold.
We want some resources.
You know? Yeah. Or, right. Or, you know, if you're a politician, one of the greatest things you can do to distract your population who's hungry is, you know, the heathens out there need to be fought, need to be colonized. We need to take their resources and we'll become wealthy.
Yeah.
So, classic. It's astonishing to think, though, what happened to the New World in particular, or what they called the New World at the time, which was what we now know as North, South America, Central America. Prior to Columbus's explorations in 1492, the estimates are, the scholars, you know, it's hard to know for sure, but on the order of 100 million deaths occurred just following that. So prior to that, there were probably over 100 million people living there in North and South America. 90% or so died off.
And that's the smallpox and other diseases.
Yeah, influenza and smallpox, Europeans, et cetera, et cetera.
And violence. I mean,
and violence,
to
yeah.
To a smaller degree, but...
Yeah. And that's so, but then, you know, there's a feedback loop, of course, where 90% of your population dies. What happens to your ability to grow food and have political stability and your religion's getting destroyed at the same time?
Yeah. So imagine the religions that are born from that, too.
Yeah.
Talk about upheaval.
Total upheaval. So that is a death that is considered to be maybe unprecedented in human history, that level of die-off.
It has to be. And I also think it's important to think in context. You know, when we think of like, you know, U.S. history, right?
Yeah.
Like early colonial era coming here, the idea that there was this vast empty space,
right.
Unpopulated space,
yeah.
Is in part because it had been depopulated.
Yes.
I mean, and the size of that population is kind of, it's even for me, it's like inconceivable because we're probably talking about at a greater order or equivalent to Europe and
yeah.
In communities very diverse with diverse languages,
yeah.
Hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands of different cultures in the Americas with
yeah, there's
large population centers and very complex and
yeah.
All that gone.
All that gone. There's actually, you know, reports of the same people, the same, you know, Spaniards showing up somewhere and then going back 10 years later and basically all these villages they had showed up to are gone. Like they can't find people anymore. So yeah. The die-off was incredibly swift and so swift that it's now looked at by climatologists as perhaps something that positively fed into what's called the Little Ice Age. So I mentioned earlier that the medieval warming period was kind of waned, and it was a cooling trend in Europe. And it looks like this may have accelerated. So you have 90% of the population die off. Forests come back like crazy.
You're talking in North America.
Yeah, now. And possibly parts of South America.
Okay.
And it pulls so much CO2 out of the air that from ice cores, we can tell that the parts per million of CO2 dropped by 7 to 10. Parts per million. And so you had a normal cooling pattern going on through other cycles. But this then accelerated that, accentuated that. So of course, it gets even colder in Europe. It gets worse. Like the crop failures get worse. Right. And
this harkens back to that episode we did last season on positive feedback loops.
Completely, right. Yeah. And so they're even
amplifying. This ain't positive.
So Europe is right. now even more motivated to do this colonialism because they are struggling even more.
Wow. Yeah. Right. That's wild.
Yeah, and I think it's important to talk about, you know, we're talking about the sort of the early history of this with the Catholic Church and Spain and Portugal. There are other European powers who essentially adopted this doctrine of discovery and apply the same logic, even though they were not part of the Catholic Church. You know, they didn't necessarily look to the Catholic Church for approval authorization.
Yeah, this is into the Reformation period. You're kind of fast forward 100 years, and they're still making these calls, right? Back to
hundreds of years, right? Yeah. So, I mean, that same mindset, and I think this is why we're wanting to talk about this as a watershed moment. This idea that lands that are new to you, right? We call this the age of discovery, right? Which is bullshit, right? But a discovery for Europeans. To walk into to a situation like that and to say, this is ours for the taking, right? Yeah. That mindset, even though it was no longer about converting heathens, there was no religious justification for it any longer, still permeated.
It had become sort of this like political sphere had now fully adopted it, I guess, in a sense.
Right? Yeah, right? I mean, that notion of colonization, I'm not as worldly as the two of you, so I always got to come back to the U.S., but that attitude is all over the place in early U.S. history and dealing with indigenous peoples here. I mean, talk about pushing people off of land, making bogus treaties that you were never going to honor, direct fighting where you go in with well-armed soldiers and wipe people out, ongoing genocide, intentionally spreading disease. I mean, it's a horrible history that is utterly defined by that mindset of what you said, Asher. This is ours, even though you were already there.
And of course, there are ongoing justifications of people. I mean, you brought this up, Jason, and we've talked about this quite a bit, where a belief system is sort of invented after the fact to justify behaviors, right? So initially, you might have the Catholic Church giving approval for something under the guise of conversion, saving souls, right? Mm-hmm. And if you look at the U.S. history, you see a sort of similar dynamic around, like, we're actually going to educate and modernize these native populations, right? We're going to take over and we're going to make them like us, you know, for their good. Sticking with the U.S., I just want to point out that this is actually the doctrine of discovery, that this watershed moment that we bring back to the 15th century actually made it into U.S. law. Which is absolutely bananas. That's
shocking, right? Like referring back to this, right? Right.
I don't know. Is it shocking? I mean, we people always talk about the Magna Carta and about, you know, I mean, this stuff just somehow survives.
But we're talking centuries later.
Centuries later.
So in 1823, you know, in the Supreme Court case, the doctrine of discovery was actually used by the Supreme Court as part of U.S. federal law and used to dispossess Native peoples from their land. In a unanimous decision, the Chief Justice at the time, John Marshall, wrote that the principle of discovery gave European nations an absolute right to New World lands and Native peoples just certain rights of occupancy.
I use that at Jason's house. I came here, it's now mine, and I let him use it in certain ways.
It's nice. I mean, it's a nice place. I mean, I'm happy to have you around.
And it's not just in law, which is, like I said, bananas, but, you know, you look at the Monroe Doctrine.
Yeah.
You look at Manifest Destiny.
Yeah.
You know, which we are taught in school. I don't know if they're still teaching Manifest Destiny as much in school, but it's just like a profound, it presented such a profound part of, like, you know, the story of progress in the United States. Go west, my son.
I think we're still on it because the Earth is a globe, and you can keep going west until you get back to the East Coast.
You're wrong. It's flat, and you fall off at some point. I'm sorry.
Yeah, but I do want to point out, it's easy to bash on the U.S., and we know enough about it to do that, and we're from here, so I feel comfortable doing that. But also, like you said, I'm way more worldly than you are, Rob. you're more Southern than I am, though. So, when I travel around the world, it was...
Oh, Mr. World Traveler.
Burning kerosene. I saw this dynamic play out everywhere. Australia and the Pacific. Obviously, you know, the prison colony, Australia.
Wait, Georgia has some claim to being a prison colony as well.
Okay, good, right. one of my favorite places to visit was New Caledonia, and I've been there 6 times, an island in the South Pacific. And I kept going back there because my family had plans that I was...
I think you got a book over there.
Yeah, I got it right there. Actually, yeah, there? You can cite it. The floor of New Caledonia, my plant family. Anyhow, very exciting place. But... you show up to New Caledonia, and there's the capital city there is called Noumea, and it's like a little French city. It's all French colonial architecture, but in the South Pacific, French cuisine, boutiques. It's a stunning.
Lots of souffles.
Yeah, exactly. Just wonderful crepes.
People talking like this.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Oh, oui, oui. So it is a shock, you know, to go to these places and realize. And what you see, though, is the mining interests. Like, that place is a mineral wealth haven. And so you realize why it was colonized and why they still have as it's an overseas territory. It's like similar to, like, you know, having a U.S. state, in other words.
But, yeah. More of those little dudes with metal detectors fanning out over New Caledonia, stripping out the riches.
Yeah. So it is like we mentioned, the Australian geographer I mentioned earlier, it was used to colonize the globe in many ways.
Yeah. Well, look, I may not be as worldly as you are, but I can still read, okay?
Yeah, so, good.
Back when I was doing research for my book, Enough is Enough, I came across this famous conference that took place. And I think it's really illustrative of the mindset, this colonizer mindset we're talking about. And maybe you guys have heard of it. It's the Scramble for Africa. Okay, so go back to 1884. So, you know,
that wasn't actually the name of the conference, was it?
Well, yeah, I'm sure they were a little more politically savvy, but that's kind of what it's come to be known
as. Got it,
as
okay.
After the fact.
1884.
1884, the head of Germany was Otto von Bismarck, and he was getting really worried that Great Britain and Portugal were going to come into Africa and mess with his plans for controlling the Congo Basin. And so he was trying to figure out how to maintain Germany's control there. So he thought, well, maybe instead of getting involved in a big European war, because, you know, a few decades later, you'd see how damaging something like that could
be.
He thought international diplomacy was the way to protect
that
national
interests. That sounds good. Sounds good. Yeah, nice.
So this is like the first UN, it must be, right?
Yeah, exactly like that. Except that I was going to say it was very exclusive. In some ways it was, but the list of countries that attended this thing surprised me. So here he is, he's got a conference. He invites Great Britain, France, Portugal, Netherlands, Belgium, Spain. Okay, that you sort of get. But then he invites the United States, Austria, Hungary, Sweden, Norway, Denmark, Italy, Turkey, and Russia.
Did you just say this was a conference about Africa?
Yeah, exactly. That's what I said. Okay, so here's the agenda, 3-part agenda
nice.
To the conference.
That's simple.
One is freedom of trade in the Congo Basin.
freedom of our trade.
Our trade, yes, yeah. European trade. Two is freedom of navigation on the Congo and Niger rivers. And three, this is the best part in my opinion, rules to follow when taking possession of new territory.
They're
playing a game of Risk or something.
It's like there's a territory registry somewhere like in Europe that you have to call, you know, said like, oh, yeah, this is mine. I drew this map.
Oh, no, I called it. I said shotgun first.
Yeah. It's like,
Oh wait, Belgium called it. So this conference, amazing. You know, usually you think, okay, a good 3-day conference. No, this conference started on November 15th, 1884, and ran till February 26th, 1885.
That's because they spent a lot of time trying to get the input of African nations.
That's about 100 days.
That, share is incorrect.
No?
So, yeah, I mean, this is kind of now viewed as a land grab that was done, obviously, without consent. And you had colonial cultures and external economic institutions that got superimposed on people who had a real history and a culture of their own.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it would be nice to think, God, that was so long ago, ancient history. That's not that friggin' long ago.
It's not that long ago.
1884, 1885.
Right.
No, not that long ago. I want to step it further back just for a second, because we've talked a lot, well, we could talk a lot more, but we've talked about the human impacts, right, mm-hmm. of all of this. I think there's another part of this that we shouldn't ignore, which does go all the way back to the papal bulls and what was communicated there, which was granting rights over peoples and land.
Yeah.
Right? And I don't think we should ignore the impact and the attitude views towards land itself and nature as a whole, because this isn't just about exploiting peoples and taking over for resources. You know, this is about our relationship with how we viewed land that we didn't inhabit, you know, quote unquote, we mean Europeans here, right? And how that's also been really deeply embedded.
Well, and that's, again, like just expanding the expansionist mindset or the exploitative mindset. You see it going on all over the place today. If we go back to the scramble for Africa, you've sort of got a new flavor of that happening now and has been happening over the last decade or so, where you got all these foreign corporations coming in and buying up as much land as they can for the express purpose of growing crops and basically
export.
Agricultural goods to ship back home.
Yes. And of course, the mineral wealth of Africa is still under a huge amount of pressure, also related to things like batteries and copper wires and all the stuff we talk about for renewable energy infrastructure.
Yeah. And it's not just Africa either.
No.
I mean, that's happening all
around the world. It's happening all over.
Yeah, and look, it's corporations have been using doctrine of discovery precedent and the application of law to justify all kinds of dispossession of peoples from native lands, not just for, you know, we're talking about kind of the very, very modern examples of that with maybe rare earth minerals and other things, but look at oil and gas companies and the extraction of, as soon as a resource is discovered, there's a justification for basically going to exploit it.
Look, we have an economic system that explicitly rewards that kind of action and behavior. If you can exploit something, be it labor, be it resources, you earn mega profits, you're doing what you're supposed to do according to the rules of engagement.
And there's still work to just like keep this going and accelerate it. It's very large, very long time horizons. I'm thinking of the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative, which is a comprehensive plan to better integrate all of Eurasia and Africa in trade network with ports, railroads, you know, superhighways, et cetera, et cetera. And an amazing number. Most nations of the world are like, yay, thumbs up. Because they're all still this mindset of, you know, the neoliberal paradigm of globalization and trade. So it's fascinating. Like you're saying, it you could go all the way back to the papal bull and all the way to the present, and it really hasn't changed much.
Yeah, and I would say that sickness manifests itself not only everywhere you look, but kind of on this planet. But but when we think about even beyond, right? I mean, the idea of discovery, right? There's a concept of terra nullius, you know, this idea of empty land that's connected to the doctrine of discovery. That, you know, what are our new edges, the new, you know, frontier, right? We got the friggin' metaverse, but you look at Jeff Bezos, who's like wanting to go harvest the moon so we can colonize space, or Elon Musk saying let's go to Mars, you know, and it's that same exact mindset.
Well,
interestingly, I would even challenge us to recognize or at least contend with the possibility that even the way that we think about the climate crisis and solving the climate crisis is an extension of that sort of disease of the mind, and that like we tend to think of the atmosphere, mm-hmm. we think of the climate as ours. Like we're so concerned about the human impacts of climate change and trying to solve it for humanity, and not ever sort of, or very rarely part of the conversation is about the impacts to nature and other species beyond ourselves, which is again, that same mindset. If it's all for us, however we divvy it up.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if I don't want to take us down the pathway of conspiracy theories, but we're talking about all this papal bull stuff. And then you bring up Elon Musk. Is the papal related to PayPal in some way?
Oh, my God.
It is all.
We got to write a novel. Well, no,
get
you make
it on the phone, please.
I do appreciate, Sherry, this insight of how far maybe our. We've got it like a sickness. And part of that strikes me is how much it has this self-replicating thing going on. Like colonization breeds this homogenization. Well, there's another big fancy word. But the idea that, you know, you come up with a way to set up your fields and a way to set up your animals and a way to set up your cities. It's almost like a video game, like SimCity or
franchised.
Yeah, like you drop it down on some other landscape and start running things the same way. And it's like the end game, of course, is that everywhere around the globe has got this exploitative sickness and is all run the same way. And we're getting farther and farther down that road. And you can just see that's the crazy town moment. That's where, you know, that's why. We're in this overshoot situation.
Right.
There are some scholars and thinkers who, at least this has been sort of new territory for me to discover, but you know, have developed this concept of decolonial ecology. And some argue that this idea of the Anthropocene, right, which is sort of this new term that has been developed to express a new geological period, right, mm-hmm. where humanity has now ultimately, you know, fundamentally changed the geology of the planet. And they sort of dispute that and say, it's not the Anthropocene. I mean, humans have been interacting with nature and for eons and eons and eons, right?
Since even before the papal bulls.
Since even before the papal bulls, right? And there are ways of doing that, of human interaction with the environment that are much more sustainable, that maybe don't leave a geological marker, you mm-hmm. know, on the planet. And instead they argue that sort of this new area of colonization is really that moment. You know, they coined this term the plantationocene, you know, which gets to what you were just talking about, Rob, which is like turning everything in a sense into a plantation.
Right.
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 Can we just agree to call it the plantationocene just for fanciness?
You could do that. Let's see if it catches.
Well, what's interesting about, you know, if I go back to, you know, the cultural materialism mindset, a lot of this colonization becomes almost a management problem where you are looking for the trade goods. You're looking for the commodities. You're looking for the things that you can bring back into the center and financialize. And that always is going to require sort of a simplification of what you're doing. Much easier to have a plantation that is all one thing, for example. So this kind of goes, this then imposition or this looking at nature and these lands and not really valuing the diversity. Well, that's hard if you're in this kind of commodification mindset and globalization mindset. So that is fascinating.
Well, that's a really nice insight, Jason. But since I now own this place, I'm going to go look for some commodities that I can stick in my belly. I've got a refrigerator down in a kitchen, and I'm getting kind of hungry. So
I'll cook some sourdough for you or something if you want.
Whatever. You occupy the place. As long as you don't get in my way, we're good.
Okay.
Okay, you guys, we've been doing reviews for a while and all these great five-star reviews. I'm going to
give you... They're all fake, right?
Oh, well, I don't know. You be the judge. I'm going to do a real one here. One star, arrogant and one-sided is the is the subject line. I listened to your podcast for a month trying to discover why you are supported by the Post-Carbon Institute. I stopped after I found your attitudes to be close to bullying and dismissive.
Wow.
I got to agree. You guys are so bullying and dismissive. I never get to say anything in this podcast.
I'm so confused by this. Whole month. Thank you. That's actually wonderful.
That's good. That might
I
be a record.
How many this person listened to. And secondly, I guess they're not aware that
I'm the board president.
That we all work at Post-Carbon Institute, or with Post-Carbon.
You guys are doing it again. You're being bullying and dismissive right now.
I'm just trying to be explanatory. I'm sorry, if you came across as heavy-handed or sarcastic.
Not for everybody, but we do appreciate the review anyway. Yeah. So please, if you are listening to the show, get out there and give us a review. Thanks.
Every decision I've ever made in my entire life has been wrong. My life is the complete opposite of everything I want it to be.
If every instinct you have is wrong, then the opposite would have to be right.
Well, if we're going to do the opposite, what are we going to do? Let's think big picture first. You know, what are the crises we worry about? We're worried about the loss of biodiversity. We're worried about the ability for ecosystems to persist and clean water and air and sequester carbon. These are critical foundations for life on this planet. And what's fascinating is that the most intact biodiverse ecosystems still remaining are managed by indigenous people around the world. And
well, in the U.S., it's military bases, actually, but
globally, I'll give you a global perspective.
Right, right.
By a huge amount.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. And I think those are under threat in many cases as well. There's incursion, right? There's illegal incursion. There's legal incursion with roads being put through these areas still for trade purposes, et cetera, that then lead to fragmentation.
For extraction.
And for extraction, exactly. So fight for the rights of these people to maintain these lands, I think, is really important. And there's an organization that does that. It's called NIATERO. So that's one of the things we can do.
Can you spell that for our listeners?
NIATERO.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that there's actually quite a movement afoot of a collection of organizations that are working on rights of nature and various forms of protection of both indigenous rights and land rights, which is super important, obviously. I think just bringing it back to sort of the mindset thing we talk so much about, what you talked about is like an argument, Jason, of why, even if from a selfish perspective, it would be important for us, right?
Yes.
For us, by us, I'm defining us in Western advanced nations, you know, if you want to call it that.
Advanced? I'm not sure I'd go there.
Quote unquote advanced. Yeah. I should have. Just like we would say, quote unquote developed.
How about high consuming nations?
Very
advanced disease.
Right. Here in Western disease.
Advanced deterioration. Anyways, that, you know, even if you're doing out of like selfish motivation, the idea that like it is in our interest to protect these remaining lands of biodiversity and lands maintained by indigenous peoples, which gets to me in a sense, this shifting our mindset. It's like our relationship with nature and with one another. Mm-hmm. And I would just start by talking about our relationship with each other. It's like seeing that the exploitation of other people is ruining us all means shifting our relationships with one another, focusing on kind of going from exploitation to reciprocity in a sense, like detransactionalizing relationships, thinking more about like, not what am I getting from this person, but what am I giving, or what is how do we do mutual support?
Yeah, like don't accept an extra amount of power for yourself if that means you got to exploit a bunch of other people to get it.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And I think about this in relation to the land, you know, as somebody who lives on a farm, sort of thinking about property rights. You know, we own this land. In a legal sense, that's true. But also what I think about practically, okay, is that this land isn't something necessarily that belongs to us, but it's something that we belong to. So having that mind shift of back to your saying reciprocity. If I belong to the land, I'm going to want to give back to that land because that land is giving back to me, and it becomes more of that circular kind of relationship. So looking out for and caring and being thankful for the land, as opposed to then just exploiting based upon an ownership thought.
And a legacy too. I mean, you're gonna die someday, and that land would still be there with the ability to have someone else in relationship with it.
Unless my consciousness is uploaded to somewhere. Like,
yeah, okay. Well, you'll be colonizing the metaverse.
Yeah.
Or you go to Mars.
Yeah.
Well, you keep talking about the colonial mindset, and the phrase that usually comes up to do the opposite is decolonizing the mind. So, you know, and I've often struggled with what the hell does that mean? Like, I don't want to have a colonizer mind or a colonialized mind, even though we know I do from all the pop culture references that
colonized
I constantly
by
bring
bad
up.
80s films.
Advertisements.
But, you know, you guys have just brought up two of the things that would be how to decolonize your mind is to change how you think about you're in relationship with people, change how you think about how you're in relationship with the land and behave accordingly. And I think another one that kind of ties back to the economics work I've done in the past is instead of trying to get as much as you can all the time, instead of trying to expand your domain, try to find that point of what is enough.
Yeah.
And that can apply to the economy of a nation, sort of enoughness. That's the idea of the steady state economy rather than a perpetual growth economy. But you can bring this down to your household and to yourself as well. I mean, you know, most people are playing that game. Whoever has the most wealth and the most toys wins. But we know that isn't true. I think it's whoever has these virtuous relationships with each other and with the land and gets that happiness, that satisfaction that comes with that. So really, to me, that's one of the ways I think that I can try to decolonize my mind is figure out what is enough.
Okay, Rob, well, I've had enough of listening to you, so why don't we go get enough beer?
Yeah, let's colonize us some beers.
Thanks for listening. We just gave you a whole bunch of do the opposite ideas so you can take action in your life and community. If that's too much at this time in your life, do something real simple. Give us a 5-star rating on Spotify or any other podcast app and hit the share button to let your friends know about Crazy Town.
Hey guys, great show today. Learned a lot about the history of the Catholic Church and the relation between religion and society and how religions often are a reflection of what's going on in the broader culture and what the needs are of the place and the time. And I mean, this just fits right in perfectly to today's sponsor, Apostles of the Sacred Sperm. Let me explain what they're about. No, this is a serious issue, guys.
Oh, sorry.
Okay. Well, you know, as sperm counts are plummeting from ubiquitous environmental toxins, guys, we can no longer take sperm for granted or waste it on frivolous activities.
Every sperm is sacred.
Yes. Apostles of the Sacred Sperm is a new religious group, and it's dedicated to enhancing sperm counts. Its members vow to protect themselves from unnecessary exposure to anything that could possibly lower their sperm counts. Okay, guys, no hot tubs, no plastic water bottles.
Oh.
All natural clothing and bedding materials. You're going to like this. This is a nice one. Simple homes made of wood, straw, and mud harvested from the least damaged ecosystems on the planet.
Yeah. So can we get those from like pristine indigenous lands?
That's where they're coming from.
Okay. Awesome.
Yeah.
Great.
And all sperm emitted from our devoted priestly caste is quickly frozen and available for donation. If you are in need, buy semen from the Apostles of the Sacred Sperm. Guaranteed to be the cleanest, liveliest, and straightest swimming sperm remaining. Go to their website, okay? Write this down. Get out a pen and pencil, whatever you got. ASS.love to learn more and order your sperm today. I'm really proud of this sponsor, guys, and I hope you are too.
Crazy Town. Da, 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 crazy Town.